The Triathlon Show 340. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Dr. Philip Larsen. Philip is Associate Professor at the Swedish School of Sports and Health Sciences, and he's also the Chief Science Officer at Silicon Valley Exercise Analytics, or SVEXA for short. In this interview, we will discuss research conducted by Philip and his team on finding the line between enough training, appropriate training versus too much training, and how they have used various physiological and cellular markers, and how they're planning to take these findings from the lab and apply them in the field. Some ongoing research there that we tease a little bit, and we will hear more about that in the future, I'm sure. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Roka. Roka produces exceptional quality triathlon wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, performance sunglasses, and prescription eyeglasses and sunglasses. All of Roka's eyeglasses and sunglasses come with their patented Geico anti-slip technology, so they will never fall off your face. They are also unbelievably lightweight and have fantastic optics. The performance sunglasses are developed for and tested in the most challenging conditions and used in sports from triathlon through speed skating and outdoor and adventure activities. And for prescription glasses, there is a home tryout program, and you can renew your prescription with a simple online vision test at home in front of your computer. All products have multiple options for frame and lens, and they all come with a 2-year warranty. So check them out and visit roka.com/TTS for 20% off your order. And thank you to Zen8. The Zen8 Indoor Swim Trainer is a swim training tool that you can use at home, allowing you to improve your technique, work on power and stamina, and save time and stay consistent. It is a fantastic way to work on swim-specific core activation, as the instability element of the bench forces you to stabilize your core, and it helps you to work on a high elbow catch, as the height of the swim bench is perfectly designed for forcing you to keep that elbow up. You can get tips and specific workouts to use on the trainer on Zen8's social media channels like Instagram and YouTube. The Zen8 Swim Trainer is very affordable, and even more so with a 20% discount code that you can get on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. If it helps you get more consistent with your swim training, it might be one of the best investments that you can make. One note about this interview, my microphone did something weird. It was connected, but something that I noticed with the microphone that I'm using is that every once in a while it will decide to muffle my sound or make it sound like I'm recording in a cookie jar. So that's what happened during this interview. It's not too bad, but it's not the usual sound quality, so bear with me for that. And I got it fixed now for the intro and outro, but yeah, I didn't even notice it during the interview because I don't hear myself when I'm talking through the microphone. I just noticed it in the recording afterwards. Sorry about that. It will hopefully be back to normal for the next interview. So with that, let's get into the interview with Dr. Philip Larsen. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Philip. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Good as well. Let's start with an introduction. Can you tell the audience who you are and what you're doing in relation to endurance sports and science?
Yeah, sure. So I'm associate professor at the Swedish School of Sport and Health Science in Stockholm, Sweden. And I'm also working as CSO in a company called SVEXA, or Silicon Valley Exercise Analytics. And yeah, I have been working with the national team in orienteering for a couple of years now as a physiologist and nutritionist. And my research is mainly about endurance sports, I would say, like from muscle physiology perspective.
Yeah, you go into the details of what's going on in the cells and in the mitochondria and so on, as we'll discuss shortly. Yeah. From your own sporting perspective, do you have a background in any sports? Have you been actively participating in sports?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been training my whole life, and it's mainly endurance sports. I started with orienteering as a kid. I did it on a very recreational level, just for fun. Kept doing that until my teenage years. I was maybe 15, 16. Then I switched to do a little bit of athletics, running middle distance most of the time. And then, like, I was maybe in my 20s, I switched to triathlon. Started with sprint triathlons, went to the longer distance, doing Ironman, stuff like that. And in my 30s, I got a lot of kids. I have 3 kids now. And now I'm just a recreational commuter athlete, mainly cycling, doing a few ultra endurance runs and stuff like that. But I'm still very active, so to speak.
Cool. Great. So, yeah, we'll have the links to the studies that we'll discuss today in the show notes so listeners can follow along if they want to. The first one that we have on the list is called Excessive Exercise Training Causes Mitochondrial Functional Impairment and Decreases Glucose Tolerance in Healthy Volunteers. That's a lot to digest. But can you describe in simple terms what were the hypotheses that you wanted to test with this study?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, it sounds very complicated and technical, but so like in the projects we are doing right now, we want to have the athlete's perspective on what's happening in the muscles. And like the starting point for this project was that, okay, so everyone knows, like if you're an athlete or a coach on a high level, you know that if you increase your training load, you will get better. You increase it even more, you will get even better. But then you come to this breaking point when you don't get any benefits anymore, although you increase the training. And then after a while, you can become, we call it overreached, or that can develop into the overtraining syndrome. It's a spectrum. So, and what we wanted to find was what is the optimal training dose, more or less, and what is happening when you go from the optimal training dose and you increase that a little bit. Then you're starting to get what we call maladaptations. You don't get any positive effects anymore. And we were really interested in this breaking point and designed a study to understand what is going on when you train too much.
Yeah. So tell us about the protocol, because it was a very kind of neat protocol to find that breaking point, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it was not neat for us as researchers, and it was absolutely not neat for the subjects involved. So it was really hard. But what we did, we took recreational athletes. So we wanted them to have some kind of training background. So if they were like completely untrained or unexperienced, we thought that it's all likely that they wouldn't like the training, or they would drop out and things like that. So we found recreational healthy students, so to speak, with some kind of training background, but they were not like doing interval training on a daily basis or ever almost. And what we did was like we took 5 biopsies, like on approximately each week. And the first week was very light training.
It's 5 biopsies in total, so approximately one each week. Not 5 biopsies per week.
No.
Just to clarify that.
Yeah, exactly. So first week, first baseline testing, then a light week of training, and then it was a week of what we call like moderate training. So in the end of that third week, we wanted them to be like optimally trained. So we tried to design the best possible training stimulus we could for them. So quite a lot of training, but also some recovery. So they should be like optimally trained by them. And by the end of that week, they were pretty tired. They felt that, okay, so now it could be time for some rest. But then we gave them this overtraining week where we had almost daily, really hard interval sessions. And by the end of that week, of course, they became like all the symptoms of someone who's been training really, really hard with lack of motivation, starting to feel really bad in the muscles, like heavy legs and stuff like that. And they couldn't push the heart rate up during these intense training sessions. And at the end of that week, we took another biopsy, did more tests. And then after the overtraining week, we let them recover with only light training for another week. So it was like 4 weeks of progressive, harder and harder training and one recovery week.
Mm. And can you just briefly detail, so how much training did they do in the first week or the light week of training compared to then the fourth week, the overtraining week, to get us an idea of where they progressed to and where they progressed from?
Yeah. So remember that they didn't have any experience with this kind of interval training. So it was 4 minute intervals or 8 minute intervals that were supposed to be all out. So they were instructed to give their absolute best to produce the best average power output that they could do with our motivation. So the first week was about one or two sessions, and then the second week it was three sessions, as I recall, and they progressed until the overtraining week, which was almost daily. So I think they had like one rest day during the overtraining week.
Mm. Yeah. So they were only all the sessions they did were interval sessions. They didn't do any continuous training, easier training, but it was progressed from those two weekly sessions to six sessions, but it was all as done as interval training, as intense training.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was a crucial part of the protocol, that we didn't give them any easy distance rides or things like that. So it was only high intensity interval training.
Yeah. And for these athletes, when they were not athletes, they were recreational or they were healthy volunteers, I guess you would call them. To add more easy training would probably not have done. It would have just overtrained them sooner, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So then what did you measured a few different things as you talked about. You took biopsies. You also measured performance characteristics and things like VO2 max and so on. Where do you want to start? Which type of results do you want to start discussing first? We can just go through the most important ones and what they mean.
Yeah. So I can start with the most common physiological measures when you do training studies. And that is like the cardiovascular adaptation. So increased VO2 max, like lower lactate at submaximal work rates and stuff like that. And physical performance, of course, which was measured as the power output during the interval sessions. And when we did those measurements, like then we didn't see anything that was striking. So when they increased the training load, they got higher and higher VO2 max, maximal oxygen consumption. The lactate levels at submaximal work rates decreased. The heart rate at submaximal work rates decreased. So everything according to the textbook, how it should be when you experience positive adaptations to the training load. And the only thing that was after the overtraining week, the only thing that we saw was that the poor performance did not improve further. So this, remember that, again, this was like recreational students, volunteers, and they had like a really good improvement in performance from week to week just by including this interval training. So they improved by a lot each week. But during the hardest, after the hardest training week, there were no improvements at all. And some of them decreased, some showed smaller improvements, but overall it was there were no change, no improvements after, despite the hard training.
Yeah, and did you say in that last week that VO2 max, was it also stagnant, and lactate, were they also stagnant, or did they still keep improving even in the overtraining week?
They kept improving, actually. So you can see this almost like a staircase. They just got better and better and better.
And then perhaps moving on to the mitochondrial adaptations, what did you do? What did you test, and what did you find?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these were like the crucial measurements. So we took muscle biopsies, and what we do with the muscle biopsies is that we isolate the mitochondria. So yes, to So the mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell. They are the ones producing the ATP that you need for muscle contraction. And adaptation, like positive adaptations to training, should be more mitochondria, and mitochondria with higher respiratory capacity or higher oxygen uptake. And when we did that, so we, in the first weeks, in the first 3 weeks, we saw this improvement in mitochondrial respiration. But after the overtraining week, we found a quite substantial decrease in mitochondrial respiration.
And mitochondrial respiration basically means the oxygen uptake of the mitochondria. Is that correct? Or
yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
One thing that was unique to this, special to this study, is that when you measure mitochondrial respiration, you can do it in two ways, more or less. You can either take a whole muscle, like a fiber bundle, then you permeabilize that, and you measure the oxygen uptake, like you have the mitochondria intact inside the fibers, and then you measure the oxygen uptake per gram of muscle tissue. But what we did was that we broke the muscle cells or the muscle fibers, took out the mitochondria, so we have the isolated mitochondria, and we measure the respiration on them. And doing that, like if you measure in the permeabilized fibers, you don't know if you have an increase in mitochondrial content or if it's the actual mitochondria themselves that have an increased respiratory capacity. But doing the isolation, yeah, we can assess that parameter much more closely.
Yeah, yeah. Just for the listeners, to clarify, mitochondrial content in that context means you have more mitochondria. So even though the mitochondrial respiration might have been lower, if you would have measured the whole muscle fiber, then you wouldn't necessarily have known that the respiration, or you wouldn't have known that the respiration was lower, in case that the number of mitochondria or the mitochondrial content went increased. So that makes sense that you did that. Yeah. So the mitochondrial respiration impaired, and then you also tested some parameters related to glucose tolerance and also the substrate utilization, which I think might be interesting to talk about as well.
Yeah. So the glucose tolerance test is this is a diagnostic test to test if someone's got type 2 diabetes, for example. And what we did is, so they come to the lab, fasting overnight, and they get 75 grams of glucose or pure sugar in water solution, and they drink it, and then we measure glucose over 2 hours. And of course, when you drink glucose, you can see that your blood sugar increases, and if you're healthy, you will see that it peaks after maybe an hour and starts to drop back again. And the expected effect of training is that, like, if you have positive effects on glucose tolerance, you would see that this curve decreases as an adaptation to the training. So you're expecting to get better or higher insulin sensitivity and better glucose uptake in the muscles. But what we found was that after the overtraining week, we found a big decrease in glucose tolerance. So the glucose curve got bigger, so to speak. They peaked at a high level and it didn't decrease as fast. So this is it's the opposite to the expected after a training period, I would say.
Yeah, but did you see any positive changes in the first 3 weeks, just like you did with some of the other measures, or was it only after the last week that that you saw that negative change?
No, the first weeks it was unchanged. So these were they were really healthy subjects, and you can't really expect a decrease if they're starting out at a really healthy level, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. And what about substrate utilization? You tested that as well with fat and carbohydrate oxidation, I think at a submaximal intensity.
Yeah. So, just to explain substrate utilization. So, you have carbohydrates, you have fats. And the body, like a healthy body, can choose between those two fuels, both at rest and during exercise. And what we found was that throughout the training protocol, and like regardless if they were like optimally trained or overtrained, the preference for fat as a fuel increased. So even when they were like in the beginning of the training period, you can see that they switched and chose to burn fat as a fuel to a higher and higher extent. And when they were overtrained, actually they burnt a lot of fat. So that was not like mechanistically linked to what you found on the mitochondrial level. So you would like, there are theories on like diabetics, for example, that if you have diabetes, some people think that this could be related to an impaired capacity to burn fat or choose fat as a fuel. But we didn't see that during the overtraining phase. It was actually even higher.
And then that's something that you see in the overtraining literature, as far as I've seen anyway, that sometimes the substrate utilization and increased preference for fat despite overtraining or overreaching could be because of just low muscle glycogen content or perhaps the glycolytic pathway shutting down. But you tested both of those things as well, and I think you didn't find that to be the, at least with the muscle glycogen content, it was the same. That wasn't the reason for the negative adaptations after the overtraining week.
Yeah, this was something that was important to us, that we didn't want them to lose weight or we didn't want our findings to be explained by an energy deficit. So we measured the weight at each training session and made sure that they kept the weight. And after each training session, they got like recovery drinks and we gave them standardized meals and everything we could to just match the energy expenditure, so to speak. And it was actually, the glycogen levels were actually the highest during the overtraining phase. So you can't say, so this, what we found was a lack of glycogen and all they needed to do was to eat more carbohydrates. So that was not the case in this study.
Yeah. So if we summarize things, when you had an initial improvement for 3 weeks with gradually intensifying the training or adding more of the type of training that they did, and then after adding just a bit too much on purpose, of course, the performance stopped improving and you saw a decline in mitochondrial respiration. And what are the conclusions from these results, would you say? What would you suggest are the main things to remember or that you would conclude from this study?
Yeah, what we have found is a physiological measure of the breaking point when you train too much. So, and this has not been shown before. Like if we would only have measured oxygen uptake, for example, or lactate threshold, or like some enzyme, like citrate synthase, which is an enzyme in the mitochondria, we wouldn't have seen any changes. We needed to measure mitochondrial function and we needed to do the glucose tolerance test. And we could see that when you went from the optimal training load to the excessive training load or the overtraining, then we found that these two parameters switched. And that's something that was lacking before, like something objective that you could measure that told us about this transition.
Yeah. And can you link somehow these parameters, these measurables with the glucose tolerance and the mitochondrial function to what normally happens in an overreached or overtrained state? Do you have any mechanistic theories for why these variables are important? You showed that they are, but why are they potentially important?
Yeah, now it's getting complicated. So what we thought and what was proposed before in the literature is that, okay, so overtraining, so we know that when we exercise, we produce a lot of reactive oxygen species, so free radicals that potentially can damage our cells if they are not handled by the antioxidant system that we have in our bodies and in every cells. So a lot of people thought that, okay, so overtraining might be an overproduction of reactive oxygen species, too much free radicals damaging the cells, and that could lead to these maladaptations on the physiological level. It could be involved in the mitochondrial dysfunction and also in the glucose uptake in the cells. But we measured oxidative stress. So we have like two measure. It's pretty hard to measure oxidative stress in a good way. But we found that oxidative stress was completely unchanged throughout this study, regardless of how much you trained. So it seems to be that the body wants to maintain oxidative stress at a stable level. And I believe, I don't have so much ground for this, but I believe that, okay, so the body wants to maintain homeostasis and unchanged oxidative stress levels. And one way of doing that when you overtrain could be to shut down your mitochondrial respiration, because mitochondria produces a lot of reactive oxygen species. There's other sources of reactive oxygen in the muscles too. But a good way to do it is just if you can just turn down the mitochondrial production of reactive oxygen species, then you can survive or handle this period of overtraining. But the trade-off or the punishment for doing that is that you will perform worse, like physical capacity will decrease, and if you continue doing it for a long time, you might get like symptoms of overtraining syndrome, like hormonal disturbances, sleep disturbances, and stuff like that.
Yeah, that is a super interesting theory, and sounds to make logical sense. We will discuss some training implications and applications, but let's maybe first cover the second study that you did as a kind of a follow-up or a similar study, which was called Short-Term Intensified Training Temporarily Impairs Mitochondrial Respiratory Capacity in Elite Endurance Athletes. So similar theme, but here you had a cohort of elite endurance athletes. So, can you tell us about this study?
Yeah, so it's actually, from a time perspective, so this study with elite athletes was done before we did the first study with the excessive exercise that we published in Cell Metabolism. So it was done before, but we didn't write it up until afterwards. And I also have a third study showing pretty much the same thing with, it's again, untrained individuals, and they did sprint interval training, like Wingate testing. So it was like, I think it was 10 or 11 days of 10 times 30 seconds all out on the bike. So extreme type of sprint training, mitochondrial respiration before and after. And we saw this same thing, decline in respiration. And again, now with elite athletes that we did. So it was a slightly different protocol. They trained for 5 weeks. It was like really good elite triathletes and cyclists. And they did like a hard period of training for 5 weeks. And we found the same thing, like with a decline in mitochondrial respiration. And this was before this, the first study that we mentioned. We thought that, like, this, okay, so this is completely unexpected results. We thought that we didn't have that hypothesis when we went into the first two studies. We thought that, okay, so we're going to do this training protocol, we measure respiration, and we had other hypotheses, but we expected to see an improvement in mitochondrial respiration, but we found these declines. And when we discussed it, we thought that, okay, so we're doing like pretty extreme protocols here. So could it be that this is actually overtraining that we are seeing? But we didn't know really. So we measured a lot of other stuff around, like if we could find something else, negative aspects on the muscles. But and that was like the starting point for me to design this study with 5 repeated biopsies, because I wanted to see, so if it's overtraining, so if we just increase the training dose more and more, then we should come to a point where all of this happens. So that was like the original, that's where the hypothesis came from, these two studies. And then we did a 5 biopsy one and found this breaking point, which I'm really glad that we did.
Yeah. I haven't been able to read this study in the elite athletes because you were locked out of your email, so I didn't manage to get it. But did you do 2 biopsies in that one before and one after a training protocol? So that's one of the main differences. You couldn't see how it changed throughout the training period to potentially intensified training.
No, exactly. So yeah, I would say that the main difference is that we used elite athletes, and like needless to say, it's much harder to overtrain elite athletes compared to recreational ones, because yeah, you just need a so much higher dose of training, and they are so used to it from all years of training, and usually have like a really good base training, so it's hard to do that, thankfully. Yeah.
And what was the training protocol like in that they used?
Yeah, so it was like, it's a really tough protocol. So it was it's actually a there's a diet intervention behind this too. So it was actually half of the group in this elite study, they had like a carbohydrate rich diet, and the others had a low carbohydrate diet. So like that was the primary hypothesis in that study, to look at if training with low glycogen is better or worse than training with high glycogen levels. But we didn't see any differences at all there, actually. But it was like, yeah, it was really hard training. So intervals in the morning, and then like the group with that got lots of carbohydrates, they could eat after the interval session in the morning. So they replenished the glycogen stores, and then they did like a distance ride in the afternoon. And the group that were the low glycogen group, they didn't get so much carbohydrates. So mainly fat and proteins, and started the afternoon session with much lower glycogen levels. But it was almost daily training in that study too.
Yeah, and for 5 weeks, you said?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, you mentioned there that they had two groups in that elite study, but that's one thing that I wanted to ask about the study in the healthy volunteers. You only had one group. So, can you explain, are any cautions that we should take with drawing conclusions because there was no control group? Or if you would have had a control group, how would you have, what would they have done? What would you think would be the perfect control group in that study?
Yeah, and that's exactly what we discussed. And yeah, you should, of course, you should always be careful to make conclusions about like single studies. It's always more complicated than that, especially if you try to take that knowledge and transfer it to like the real athlete setting, so to speak. So you should be careful, of course. But yeah, what we struggled with was that, okay, so if we're going to include a control group, what should that control group do? So if like the most obvious thing would be someone that only rested or just continued their normal life. But then we like take 5 biopsies in a control group that they are not changing. Yes, to show that we can measure oxygen uptake, we can measure mitochondrial respiration, we can do glucose tolerance tests, and it's stable over time in a control group. It wouldn't add any value except for showing that we could do the measurements and there were no external factors affecting what we did. So that wouldn't be like so informative. But now, like afterwards, we have another like idea for a study design, and this is crucial, and it all relates to how you do tapering for peak performance and how you do your overreaching phase. So when you train really hard so that performance drops and then you do the tapering and performance improves again. So the idea here is that if we had a control group, it would be really interesting to one group do as we did, harder and harder training until they're optimally trained. Then they overtrain for 1 week and then they taper. And then, of course, we see that they recover and they perform better after the recovery week. But it would be interesting to see that if we stop the training after optimal training, we skip the overtraining or overreaching phase altogether. So we just skipped that and went directly from this optimal training into the taper without any negative effects of too much training, and see, would that group be better than the overtraining group? And there's a lot of, controversies in the field regarding this. How hard should you, like, how hard should you do your overreaching phase? How far should you take it? Should you like overreach for 3 weeks and just dig a deeper and deeper hole and then taper and just expect it to bounce back from there? Or should you do 2 weeks? Or should it be, should you like stay afloat all the time and never be like never experience any training induced performance drop? And I think actually that like overreaching, like going after that performance drop, like that you should increase your training more and more. And when you see that, okay, so now my splits are getting worse. Now my power output is getting worse and I'm starting to feel terrible. Now it's time for taper. I don't think there's any value in doing that, like training and just waiting for your performance to drop. I think that is that in many cases, it's too late if you do that. It's a good, like it's a real red flag. If you see performance drop and you feel terrible, then you should reduce your training. But I'm pretty sure that you should start the recovery process before that. And this is not only for tapering for big events. I mean, this is the general training process, like how to improve in the long term.
Yeah. Well, this is a highly unscientific opinion, but just my coaching and athlete experiences that I 100% agree with what you just said there. That's what I believe as well. I think another aspect of the potential control group, what you said there makes a lot of sense, that you train them until they're optimally trained but not overtrained, and then you stop it there, or you go into taper there. But another thing that could be interesting, and this would be more of a hypothesis of finding the time course overtraining, is what if the control group does the baseline, or not the baseline week, but the first week of training over and over again. Because we don't necessarily know that it's that final week of training that overtrains them. What if it's the combination of the last 2 weeks of training? So, yeah. And yeah, it's difficult to say how long does it take to build up. What is the chronic effect of all the training you've done over the last 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 2 months, really? So that could also be an interesting aspect to look at.
Definitely. It's really hard to tell the difference between time effects and like the dose effect here, I would say. Yeah. There's a really, really, really good study done quite many years ago, not so much like 10 years ago, maybe, by Christopher Perry, looking at, he did exact same training day after day and measured like the adaptation to training. And he could see, like, I think it was just a week or maybe 10 days or 12 days, maybe. But he could like really see this, the nice time effects, that you have the biggest improvement, the biggest signaling for improved training adaptations during the first sessions. And then it just levels off this, the whole signaling process.
Well, let's discuss some implications for training. And I think maybe what you just said there with not just tapering, but the overall training process of just overloading or loading and adapting is an interesting aspect of this. So, for example, thinking about like introducing a loading period, but then recovering from it at the appropriate moment. What things would you say that we can maybe not take away, but we can hypothesize based on your results regarding those kind of load and rest cycles, if you want to call them that?
What we're looking for is something like a marker, if it's objective, that's something that you need to measure, or if it's just subjective how you feel. But you need a marker for when it's time to stop your loading phase and go into the recovery phase. And they are like, I think that most athletes and coaches are doing that by feel. So they plan for a hard week and then they just keep crushing the training. When they feel they had enough, they are recovering. But we are actually publishing a study based on the same data, where we look at, okay, so when we find this, we find some responses during the training phase. So for example, one thing is that we see that lactate, if you do this maximal, like, or really hard intervals, you can see that the lactate levels that you reach at the end of each session, it becomes lower and lower. Mm. So you are not able to push your lactate levels up to a high level when you get fatigued. So we try to delineate where is the, like, how much should you allow the lactate levels to drop before it's time to say it stop. And the same thing with the heart rate during the hard sessions. We see that it gets lower and lower, but if it's reduced by, so it's, you say you have your normal heart rate when you do hard intervals is 180. And then when you have been training hard for a few days, it's 178. When we're training hard for 10 days, it's 172 maybe. And you can see that, yes, it becomes harder and harder to push your heart rate up. But what is, like, what's the cutoff? How much should you allow it to drop before you say stop? So we use, like, a number of different metrics to, like, model where is the, what does the optimal training dose look like?
Yeah, and that's a study that you have in the works right now, or you're crunching the data and writing it up. Is that the status of the project?
Yeah, that study is it's actually submitted and it's under review. So mm-hmm. we are eagerly awaiting the response on that. But then, yeah, we have another study that's an ongoing project. I have a new PhD student now, and we want to see if we can apply this. The findings that we have, so we want to, so what we're doing is an observational study, so we are using a lot of different wearable techniques. So we are collecting data from you know, the running watches or the cycling computers on power output, heart rate during training, so we can model the training load very good. And we are using continuous glucose monitors. You might have seen a lot of triathletes are using them now, I have seen, with this, like, a patch on your shoulder, and you get, like, your minute-by-minute glucose levels. So we use that on the athletes, and we have the Oura rings. So it's a ring that you have on your finger measuring sleep cycles and sleep quality, heart rate during sleep, resting heart rate, and body temperature. So we're collecting all this data during 1 year in, like, 20 elite athletes. So they're all in the national team in different endurance sports. So they're, like, highest level athletes. And then we follow them. And what we're looking for is these patterns. So what does too much training look like based on sleep parameters, based on glucose parameters, based on heart rate during exercise and stuff like this? So it's... yeah, it's ongoing. We're, like, a little bit more than halfway through that data collection period right now. But it's, I think it's super scary and really interesting to do that, because I've been doing a lot of lab-based studies, like interventions in the lab. You take them in, you try to control for everything as much as you can. Now we're just using these wearables, put it on the athletes, and they live their normal lives, train as they usually do, and we just measure stuff. And we get the data back. But it will be, to do this kind of deep analysis on these athletes will be super interesting.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And if obviously if you can find some clear results from that study, then because it's externally valid and they're just living, going on with their own lives and their own training and mm-hmm. with sensors and wearables that are available to anybody, then that means that it becomes easier or pretty easy for people to do monitoring on their own and try to avoid a situation of overreaching or overtraining, which you can't really say for biopsies. Not many people can have a biopsy lab in their basement, so no. It's a bit more difficult to replicate.
We really hope that this will, like, we do our best now to use the findings from the lab and try to transfer them to, like, the real athlete setting. And, like, we wanted to come up with really good advice for, like, how hard to train, when to stop training. And, like, I mean, with so many, like, everyone's got a smartwatch nowadays. And then you see that, okay, so my deep sleep was 1 hour less than my friend here. So what does it mean? Does it mean anything? Well, like, I think we can explain those questions much better after this study when we have all the data. So it's it will be nice to look at the final product of that.
Yeah, and I can see a follow-up interview shaping up for when you have, well, this, you have one study in for review now and then another one in the works. So hopefully we can chat about that at some point in the future. I don't want to ask you too much about the one that's in review, because I know that you probably don't want to say too much until it's accepted. But just, you mentioned lactate and heart rate. Mm. Are those the two main markers that from those results that you're looking at as potentially important for finding that cutoff point where you need to back down on your training or potentially can see where you're going too far? Or are there any other data points or parameters that you can monitor?
Yeah, there are other parameters, but like we wanted to look at parameters that we know that coaches and athletes can use, or like that they measure themselves. So it should be applicable to everyone if you have a lactate monitor at least, or a heart rate monitor. So we used lactate and heart rate. They were like, they had a high predictive value and they were easily accessible for athletes. But then on top of that, we also have subjective measures. So yes, the Borg scale, like the RPE scale. If you do a submaximal workload, if you go run for at a specific speed, or if you cycle at a specific work output, if you then just rate how you feel in your legs or in your chest when you're doing that, like on a scale from 6 to 20 most of the time, that is also sensitive to this kind of separating being only fatigued from having done too much, going towards overreaching, overtraining. So that's good. And another thing is we use this POM scale, so the profile of mood states. We can see that, like, and that is just a questionnaire, 67 questions actually, so it's not really feasible to do all the time, but you can see that when you go over the edge, you will feel that, your mood will get worse, your energy levels and your motivation will drop, and that's seems to be linked with doing too much.
Yeah. One question on the type of high intensity training that you used in these training protocols. I'm just wondering in general if you have any thoughts on using high intensity interval training for performance and as compared to using it for health. Are there any considerations or different things to take into account when looking at those two different objectives?
One thing I want to say is that our study doesn't indicate that you shouldn't do HIIT type of exercise. So it is like a really time efficient way to improve both metabolic health, cardiovascular performance and physical performance if you have a lack of time. So if you just have 1 hour per week to train, probably you should do HIIT training or something more intense than just going for a walk or a slow run. So that it is valuable training and it's time efficient training, but you can definitely do too much of it, especially as an elite athlete. If you like, you read the studies and then you look at the comparisons between doing distance training or like at lower intensities or even threshold training and compare that to the high intensity training, you can see that most scientific studies favors the HIIT training as more effective. But you should remember that, like, you really need, like, all athletes and coaches know that you need a base, you need your aerobic base to adapt to this higher training later on. But that's like what that is from a scientific perspective is not clear. So what is it with doing many hours at a low intensity that prepares the body to better respond to the high intensity training? I haven't seen any really good answers to that actually, like on the molecular or on the cellular or mitochondrial level. I haven't seen any good mechanistic like explanations for why it is, but you can do too much, and our study shows that it seems to hurt the mitochondria, so to speak, and your metabolic health might deteriorate even if it's temporary. You have a disturbance, you can't do too much. And don't forget to do the base training.
Yeah. And I would theorize that maybe it's not so much about you have to do 6 months of all aerobic training before you do HIIT training, but maybe it's more about how long is your HIIT training period or how long do you focus on it? Mm. So you don't want to do it for, no matter how good of an aerobic base you have. I think if you do 8 weeks focused on doing a lot of high intensity interval training, mm. for most athletes, that's going to be too much. Yeah. But you can maybe do 2 good weeks and then you can rebuild, refocus on some other training, and then you do 2 other weeks. And I know this is something I wanted to get into because I heard you on another podcast in Swedish, actually. I'll link to it in the show notes because it was very good, that you talked about potentially using shorter load and rest cycles, and that potentially could be an interesting application of the results. Do you want to expand on that a bit?
It was more or less what I said before, that like you shouldn't dig yourself into a too deep hole because it will take more time than needed to get out from there. So, and I mean, if you look at like physiological responses, like how cells or organisms have this homeostatic response that they try to return to baseline and build back stronger afterwards, there's no real sense in like not allowing for recovery quite often. If you do it for too long, like it's just an accumulation of fatigue and a lot of processes in the body that like you need to get rid of damaged proteins, you need to replenish energy stores, you need to get the before like the bounce in your legs, if you want, back to be able to push yourself even further. So it's but it's really hard, like scientifically, to say that okay, you need to have short cycles because otherwise you will have mitochondrial dysfunction. There's no time for that. I don't have any scientific support for saying that. It's more when we do observational stuff, like when we see, like when you measure the response of 3 weeks of overreaching compared to 5 days, and yeah, look at over time, what is the response?
Yeah, I think the value of science like this is often that they give you some ideas that you can test out on yourself or on your athletes, and from a kind of informed position or more informed position. And but then at the end of the day, you have to see what works for the athlete, and it might not work for everybody. But you can generate ideas based on things like this, and then see how it really works in practice in the field.
Yeah.
So one final question before we start to wrap up with the rapid fire questions. If you could just give 3 pieces of advice for the listeners of this podcast that would help them improve their endurance sports performance, and this can be anything really that you can think of, what would those 3 pieces of advice be?
Yeah, I would say that it's, from working with elite athletes, I'm really impressed by all of the subjects in our new study now. They're like amazing in many different ways. But I don't think they are so special, you know, from a like genetic point of view, or what you want to say. They are like, they're doing things differently compared to normal people, I would say. And one thing, it's like obvious, it's consistency. You need to have like, you just need to repeat day after day after day doing your thing. And it's like, it's most people, when they hear that, oh, that's a boring advice. Everyone knows that. But like, do you really manage to be consistent? Do you manage to avoid sick days, injury days? Like, do you train too hard? Like, if you're not consistent, you might be training too hard in periods, but then that will punish you so that you will need to take more recovery. If you can like back it up week after week after week, and balancing load and recovery, that seems to be like the key thing that elite does, that normal, like what we say, recreational athletes, age groupers, or wannabe at elites don't have. They don't have consistency. And yeah, and so that's one thing. And like, I feel like how to get, like, how do you become consistent in your training? And this is also like preliminary data from the ongoing study, I would say. And it's like the small things. And it, this is even more boring advice, that is like sleep is one thing. And nutrition is another thing. So if you, it's really like the small, really simple things that everyone know, that you should go to bed at approximately the same time each day. You should do this, like, don't get stressed up before you go to bed. Don't stay up late, watch horror movies. Now, like, at least here in Sweden, where it's really bright now, get dark curtains so you don't get exposed to light. So we can see that. So, like, the elites get really consistent sleep compared to those that that are not on the elite level. And the same with nutrition. I think this is even more, like, I think that a lot of people make nutrition way too complicated. It's so easy. Like, the basics are so easy. Like, eat enough. Don't stress about it. Make sure that you, like, refuel after your intense session, stuff like that. That everyone, like, if you open like one book in about sports nutrition, this is like the most, like the first page, the most basic things that not so interesting to talk about, not so interesting to write about, but getting the small things right is that seems to be key.
Yeah, great advice. And now let's move into the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
It's Better Training for Distance Runners by Arthur Lydiard.
All right. And what's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Going up early in the morning.
And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I don't have any. I couldn't come up with any good names. I'm sorry.
Right.
I have lots. I don't want to pick anyone specific.
Yeah.
I have a lot of people.
Philip, do you have any social media or places where people can follow you? Or I didn't really find too much activity on your Twitter recently, but ResearchGate, I saw that you had at least, and so your studies were up there.
Yeah. No, I've been lazy. I don't have the energy to do that. Like, yeah, no special social media for me. Like, you can, the company I'm working for that I founded with colleagues is like svexa.com. So svexa.com. So we are doing a lot of, like, we're doing a lot of the things that we're talking about now. So my research is one thing, but trying to apply that to athletes and getting the, you know, advice out and doing that. So it's a, like a data analytics company. So, we're trying to do all the things that I've talked about now. So it's, and that is an exciting add-on to the research I'm doing.
And how are you working with athletes? How does it work? Do you have, I mean, I looked at Svexa's website, so I know a little bit maybe, but are you working with a lot of teams and organizations? Is that kind of the business model? And then they have their athletes use your services and testing methods and so on, or do athletes individually reach out to you for help?
All of it. Like, the business model is based on, like, we're working for companies as back end, like doing the algorithms and the calculations. Like, for example, if you have a hardware, we can do the calculations for those kind of companies. And we are working with organizations too. And also with individual athletes. So the individual athletes, it's mainly for like proof of concepts, and because we are all really interested in that kind of development. But yeah, we're doing all of it, yes.
All right. Well, I'll link to that as well in the show notes so people can have a look and see what you're all about. Yeah, thank you so much, Philip. It's been great, really fascinating research that you've done and that you have got going on. So, yeah, I really look forward to hopefully having you on in the future once you've finished up this study, where you're, the observational study that you're working on, and we can chat about that.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to talk to you.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, where we will have links to Philip's profile on ResearchGate and also his company website, Svexa. We will have links to the papers discussed here, which, just to mention the names again, where excessive exercise training causes mitochondrial functional impairment and decreases glucose tolerance in healthy volunteers, and short-term intensified training temporarily impairs mitochondrial respiratory capacity in elite endurance athletes. I also included a link to the paper that Philip mentioned by Christopher Perry about the time course of endurance adaptations, and a link to Philip's episode on Tyngre Träningssnack, a podcast in Swedish that was really good and interesting if you speak Swedish. If you need any help reaching that next big goal that you've set yourself, or you've hit a plateau and want to move past that, then consider reaching out to us and discuss coaching or working with the Scientific Triathlon training plan. We have worked with athletes of all different levels, and we would love to help you as well on your triathlon journey. Check out all the information on scientifictriathlon.com or email me directly and we can discuss your specific goals and needs. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, sunglasses, and prescription glasses, and use the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS to get 20% off your entire Roka order. And thank you to Zen8. Use the Zen8 swim trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and most importantly, your swim training consistency, and get 20% off your order on the swim trainer with the promo code that you can get on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Don't forget that it's a risk-free investment. If you don't love it after 2 weeks, send it back and you'll get a full refund. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.